You're listening to highlights from the Creative Processes interview with award-winning neurologist, Kailash Sinner. This podcast is supported by the Ian Michalski Foundation.
I'm fascinated by the extremes of the human experience, partly because it is so far away from our own experience of life, in a way. But in another way, actually, when you look at people who have neurological disorders or diseases, these are really nature's experiments. They are ways of trying to understand how the brain works for all of us. And, you know, by extrapolation from looking at these extremes, whether it be sleep disorders, neurology, epilepsy, it tells us about the workings of our own brains. And that's very much the case across all the areas of the work that I do. You know, how we regulate our emotions, how we move, how we experience the world. I think that one of the things that hopefully my books illustrate is that everybody's mind is different. And that, you know, one of the amazing things about the human experience, and indeed that manifests in terms of art and creativity, is that when we have such different minds, that is why all this creativity, all this art is possible. There are lots of artists or musicians who have sought inspiration in REM sleep, in dreaming sleep. You know, there have been lots of songs, lots of works of art that have been created, inspired by some sort of dream experience. So there's clearly something that happens in sleep that leads to the breaks coming off the creative process. There are parts of the brain that we suppress during waking life that are unsuppressed in the night. Synesthesia covers a broad range of phenomena, but at its core, perhaps the most striking of the features of synesthesia is this ability for different senses to be merged. And some people, as you say, can taste words, other people can see sounds. So one of the people that I describe in that book is actually a concert pianist. And when she plays certain notes, certain keys, certain chords, she sees colours in her vision, or she feels sensations over her body that are associated with that music. And what all of these individuals, I think, reflect is that our reality is entirely a function of how our brain works. And that, you know, synesthetes have normal brains overtly. There's nothing wrong with their brains. It's just perhaps that their brains are hyper-connected. And their experience of the world is very different from our own, which I think, on the one hand, is entirely magical. And I think must give you a very different and more full experience of life, but at the same time can be very distracting indeed. But you can understand why individuals with synesthesia are perhaps slightly more gifted creatively. And, you know, the number of synesthetes who are writers, who are poets, who are musicians is very high indeed. Sleep is really important for memory. We think that one of the primary functions of sleep is to consolidate memories, both in terms of autobiographical memories, but also in terms of emotional memories. One of the theories about why we dream is to try and clean up our memories and rid them of their emotional content, which is why some researchers have termed REM sleep, dreaming sleep, as being overnight therapy. And one of the other interesting theories about why we dream is that actually what we're doing while we're dreaming is actually tweaking our model of the world, because the brain really works not simply as an interpreter of our senses, but actually works in a rather more complicated and interesting way. It works as a prediction machine. So we expect what we're going to see, we expect what we're going to experience. And it's only when our senses are telling us something different from our expectation that we have to tweak our expectation of the world. It's difficult to do that when we're awake because we're taking in all these impulses from around us. But actually, when we're in dreaming sleep, when we're offline, that's the time to integrate our experience of the day into that model of the world that we have. And it's that sort of adjustment of how we understand the world to be that may be what's going on in REM sleep. Most of us live in an urban environment which is busy, it's exciting, it's full of stimuli, but it's also dirty and noisy and distracting. And in many respects, that's a sort of wonderful place to live, but in other respects, it's not particularly conducive to calm, to relaxation, to mindfulness. And I think that there is an increasing body of medical literature that ties these kinds of mindfulness-based approaches to actually being quite good for our brain and physical health. And what we need to try and do, and I think that there are some countries that do it better than others, who regulate their urban environments better than others, that to introduce those aspects of nature, those aspects of calm, of green, an ability to step away from that busy, throbbing city, that I think will be good for our health. I suspect that we will focus much more on those aspects of urban living, of the urban environment in the future. You know, one of the reasons why we have made such leaps forward in understanding sleep is because of the technological advances. And undoubtedly, AI is going to help that process. One of the things that we find very difficult is to extract subjective experience from individuals who are sleeping. It's almost impossible. We have to rely upon other modalities like imaging, electrical activity, a whole range of other techniques and technologies in order to interrogate the human brain. And AI will undoubtedly have a role in all of that. Wake and sleep are a spectrum. So we know that actually, even whilst we're awake, there are little areas of our cerebral cortex that seem to simulate sleep. So whilst you and I are chatting, there are small areas of both of our brains that are probably dipping in and out of sleep. And even when it comes to sleepwalking, you know, sleepwalking is a significant spectrum as well. There are individuals in whom they do some very, very simple things, like they may sit up in bed, look around, and then go back to sleep. And then there are individuals who might prepare an entire meal, who might, as we've already talked about, ride a motorbike or drive a car in their sleep. And I think that this spectrum behaviorally also reflects the spectrum from a neurological perspective, in that, you know, if you imagine that the amount of brain that needs to be awake in order to ride a motorbike, to be able to see hazards, to follow the signs, to navigate, to be able to stay balanced on a motorbike, that requires quite a lot of brain power, quite a lot of waking brain power. So the way that I would view that is actually for those sorts of individuals, the majority of their brain is awake, but it's the bits of their brain that are responsible for memory, that are responsible for perhaps a small degree of rational thinking, because of course, riding your motorbike at 3 a.m. with nowhere to go is not the most rational thing to do, is at one end of the spectrum. And then there are individuals who will just sit up or mutter something in deep sleep, whereby a very small part of the brain is awake. I think that what's going on in the world is very deeply worrying. You know, I worry for my children. I worry for society as a whole. I'm hoping that the pendulum will eventually swing back, you know, because that's what's happened in human history, is that the pendulum has swung from one extreme to another. But yes, it is very, very concerning indeed. I think that, you know, my upbringing was atheist, but it was in a very kind of almost Germanic Lutheran kind of view of what was right and wrong. And I think that that's very much fueled some of the life choices that I've made, very much with a view to kind of making the world a little bit better. I'm not saying that I have made the world a little bit better, but I think that that's what we should strive for, that it should be beyond personal gain and should be for making society a little bit better. And I try and do that through my work as a clinician. So I think that that was in part my inspiration for becoming a doctor. You started off very early on in this interview about talking about Oliver Sacks. I remember reading The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat as a 15-year-old boy and thinking that this was the most fascinating book that I had ever read. It raised concepts of what it is to be human in very neurological terms, in ways that I had never truly considered before. And I must admit to my interest in neurology and neuroscience being triggered by books like Oliver Sacks, which in some ways was the inspiration for me turning my hand to writing as well. I don't think I do it as well as him, but if one person reads one of my books and thinks, oh, this is a fascinating area that I want to pursue, then I'll have done my job. I never intended to be a storyteller. I intended to be a story listener. And of course, that's what we do day in, day out in our clinics. We listen to people's stories, we write them down, and we try and understand their stories in order to achieve diagnoses and to give treatments. That was always my intention. But, you know, it became apparent later on in life that the telling of stories for me is as powerful as the listening to stories, because it's through the telling of stories that you communicate with a whole range of individuals outside your immediate clinic room, is the first thing. But also through the telling of these stories, you create empathy, you create understanding, and you hopefully inspire the next generation of individuals to take up the torch of going to be doctors and psychologists, all these other healthcare professionals, because you engender a fascination with the brain in the same way that Oliver Sacks did with me. I guess that to consider that we don't have free will in everything that we do runs completely counter to our own experience. It's a horrendous thing to imagine that we don't have free will in any decision. But what's quite clear, and it's not just neuroscientists who believe this, there are obviously schools of philosophy who also believe this, that actually free will is illusory, that actually none of us have free will. Now, that's not necessarily a view that I particularly buy into, but I certainly think that all of us have influences on the decisions that we make and the acts that we undertake that are entirely beyond our control. I think undoubtedly society is becoming more polarized now, and I think that one of the major issues is that the, you know, in the olden days, nation states used to be tied together by a common narrative. If you look at the common narrative that ran through the United States or the UK or some other countries during the Second World War, there was a common narrative, a common view of how individuals who were citizens of that country saw themselves. And of course, one of the things that social media has enabled, whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, I think I'm fairly ambivalent to, is that that common narrative has disappeared. And now there are various strands of narratives. And we select the narrative, or we have the narrative selected for us, that most chimes with our worldview. And what that does is it causes a divergence of worldviews, which I think is perhaps, in that context, is unsurprising that we have become more polarized, because we're constantly getting our own views reinforced by the social media that we take in. One of the things that I talk about in The Man Who Tasted Words is how all of our realities are somewhat different. They're related to the experiences that we've had to date, our genetics, what we have learned, the cultures that we inhabit. And so it's important to remember that everybody's view of reality is different. But I think that what social media has achieved is in actually expanding those differences. I think it's very easy to be very pessimistic about the future. But if you look at the world in general, if you look at the number of individuals who live lives that are easier, that are better fed, that have better access to medicine, that have better access to a clean environment, to clean water, you know, those improvements have been ongoing continuously forward through the generations. And actually, as a whole, as humanity on this planet, I think people are probably leading much better lives than they were even in the last generation. I look at my children and I think about the world that they inhabit, which is a little bit kinder in some respects. I know that there are issues, but actually it is a kinder world. It's a world where, you know, the kinds of things that we saw are not acceptable anymore. If you look at the developing world, the global south, things have improved dramatically across many countries compared to when we were growing up. So I think the key thing is not to lose hope and not to be pessimistic about the future, because pessimism becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy.
We hope you've enjoyed listening to these highlights. To learn more about participating in exhibitions or interviews, click on subscribe. Thank you for listening.